said them not just for that audience, but for us today. We desire to hear all that you want us to hear from this short segment of your message. Would you help us? Would you give us those ears that we need to hear? The ability to listen deeply from our hearts. Would you do that miracle? Would you also do the miracle of taking away the distractions, both the ones that are in our minds cluttering us up, or who knows what we've been through this week? You do. So would you help us with those distractions, including the distractions that I might bring? And I pray that you would minimize those as well and keep me on the straight and narrow with what you once said this morning. I pray in the name, your name, Lord Jesus. Amen. So let's read what Jesus said in verse 27. You've heard it said. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Who said that? Well, as a matter of fact, that happens to be the seventh of the Ten Commandments. So who said those words? God himself, right? God said, you shall not commit adultery. But what does Jesus say? He says, but I say to you, really? You have something to say that you begin with a but like that, Jesus? You've heard that it said you shall not commit adultery. That was God. But I say to you, or if we read it the way the people, the original audience heard it, they would have said, but I myself say to you, in English we would italicize it, because we would want you to know that he is differentiating. But I say to you, what did he say? But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with desire for her has committed adultery with her in his heart already. That's what I say. Hear the audacity. God says don't commit adultery. But Jesus says, but I say to you, if you're looking at a woman with desire for her, you've already committed adultery within your heart. Who do you think you are, Jesus? Was God's command not enough? You think that you can stand up there on that little ledge of grass over there when God has said it and Moses wrote it down and we preserved it all of these centuries, and you think you can come along and say that wasn't enough? Do you realize what you're doing? You're adding to God's seventh commandment. Who do you think you are? How arrogant, how preposterous, how audacious. Jesus is audacious. And it's not just here, is it? If you look down in the verses that follow, six times in this chapter alone, he uses that same introduction. You've heard it said, but I myself say to you, six times, Jesus, you must really think you are somebody. Jesus is audacious. But he's not just audacious, he's radical. He says, just desiring a woman is committing adultery with her in your heart. Oh, really? And just where do you get that concept, Jesus? For all of history, adultery has been defined as a physical act. And are you now so pious and so holy that you can declare that adultery is not just in the realm of the physical, but in the realm of thought? That's a radical leap, Jesus. Are you going to impugn my morality on the basis of my thoughts? He just doesn't redefine adultery. He redefines murder, divorce, oath-taking, revenge, and love. Six times in this chapter, he goes beyond the established moral code, centuries of moral code, as delivered by God through Moses. Centuries of moral code for thousands of years. Six times he redefines God's standard. Killing someone is murder. Yes, we get that. But Jesus says, if I call someone a fool, it makes me guilty enough to go to hell. Jesus is radical. But he's not just audacious, he's not just radical, he is outrageous. Listen to what he prescribes. He says, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And And in case we missed it, he says, and if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Does that strike you as outrageous? We're going to be going around gouging out our eyes and whacking off our arms to keep us from sinning?
Spirit entirely.
how the religious leaders themselves would talk about such and such a woman, and boy, she looks hot, or whatever. And he's going, what? That's not the spirit of the commandments? So here's his opportunity, and he said, you heard it said, but I myself say, being co-author of those Ten Commandments, he rightfully says, but I myself say, he wasn't being audacious. He knew precisely the spirit of the law. He knew they were missing it completely. He wasn't being radical. How do we know that? Because with God, it has always been about the heart. Always. You remember what he said to Samuel about anointing that young boy named David? He said, don't look on the outside appearance. Don't look at the height of his stature. For God sees not as man sees. The Lord looks at the heart. That's what God sees. And Jesus is light, enlightening those people around there that day. You heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I myself say to you with authority, if you look at a woman to desire her, you've committed adultery in your heart already. Was he being audacious? Was he being radical? No, he was claiming the authority that he had to give what? Not just the logical extension of the commandment, but the deepest intention of the commandment, which has to do with the heart. It wasn't being audacious or radical. It only seemed that way to us. We only thought he was being audacious. If he was co-author of the Ten Commandments, then it wasn't being radical to say, if you desire a woman with desire, you've committed adultery with her already in your heart. It was a logical extension of the commandment, of the spirit of the commandment to our minds. We only thought he was being radical. So, was he being outrageous as well? Let me see if this illustration helps. Imagine that one of your co-workers, he's fairly new to the job, imagine that one of your co-workers is consistently late. He hasn't been on the job more than a couple months now, and it's often late for work. The manager, however, is gracious in his treatment of the late co-worker, never raises his voice, never threatens him, never says, you better, whatever, none of that. So the co-worker, your co-worker, thinks everything's okay. What he doesn't know is paragraph 42 of the employee handbook. Paragraph 42 of the handbook says, after 12 tardies in 1 year, you are terminated without appeal. Now, he signed the employee handbook because he was supposed to have read it, but he didn't read paragraph 42. And by your count, you figure your coworker has got to be close to about 10 tardies already, and there are 9 full, partially more, months to go before he can reset the clock. So one day, he sent your coworker down and you tell him, and you say, look, you are about to be in an unemployment line. You are in a crisis and you don't know it. You are going to lose your job. Listen, co-worker, the only way to protect your job is you need from here on out to be here 30 minutes early every single day for the next 9 months or you are going to lose your job. He says to you, oh, wait a minute, my manager is so nice, he never says anything. He's offended by the way you're talking to him, telling him he's in a crisis and about to lose his. I don't appreciate the way you're talking to me. You're using such a harsh voice, he says to you. And you don't understand what I've got going on back at my house. Why I'm like, I have good reasons. Are you being outrageous by telling him that paragraph 42 is about to come crashing down on his head, and in addition to the problems at home, he's going to be minus the job? You are not being outrageous. It is his perception of what you are saying that makes him think you are being outrageous. Listen to this. Grave consequences demand decisive action. You're telling your co-worker, you have grave consequences ahead. You need to take decisive action. And that decisive action requires me to be bold in telling you the truth. And that is what Jesus was doing here. Grave consequences. Do you want to be cast into the lake of, to the Gehenna? To hell, better that you lop off your hand or gouge out your eye. It is that serious. And we say, he's being outrageous. He's talking with such a harsh tone. I don't appreciate it. Decisive action requires bold truth-telling. And he is boldly truth-telling right here in this passage. It's a holy God who has said, you shall not commit adultery. And it's a holy, holy, holy God who does not merely look at the outward appearance, but looks at the heart. And Jesus knows there are Christ and a violation after violation after violation of people who have never physically committed adultery, but are breaking God's law on the heart level day after day after day. And he sends us this bold, truth-telling, harsh-sounding, outrageous-appearing, radical, audacious message. We are offended. How does he lay it on the line? How did Jesus lay it on that line? Lay it on the line that day? Well, he used hyperbole. What is hyperbole? Hyperbole is obvious and intentional exaggeration for the purpose of getting a point across. It's a purposeful overstatement, not intended to be taken literally. Why is it made? To establish emphasis. Or as they say, emphasis. Why did Jesus resort to hyperbole? Was it because of the nature of the grave consequences that awaited those who needed the message? Was it an intentional exaggeration to get the serious point across? To establish the emphasis needed. You know, those hyperbolic statements are understood more easily within your own culture than they are when they cross cultural or language barriers. Here's one that you've probably seen. Prices are going outrageous for gas. Regular's an arm, plus, and plus is a leg, and or you want premium. Now, did any of you have any question about whether that was a hyperbolic statement? But what you did take from that was gas prices are going through the roof. Another exaggeration. They're outrageous. Of course, he used hyperbole because it's a matter of the heart, as he went on to say. So cutting off the right hand, you could still sin with the left hand, right? And a blind person. I mean, you've got a left eye after you gouge out the right eye, so you can still look inappropriately with your left eye. Was he saying gouge that one out too? But a blind person. Or a person with no hands can still sin in his heart. The message is simple. He used hyperbole. Why? Because you must, he say, you must do whatever it takes. You must take this necessary, drastic action to make sure you keep God's commandment. Do whatever you must. Take those drastic measures. Why? Because of the exceedingly grave consequences. And if they are exceedingly grave consequences, as they are, as he spells them out. He is not being audacious. He is being kind enough to alert us. And if he is not being radical, he is being gracious. Wasn't it gracious of him, kind of him, to alert us that it was really a matter of the heart, that God was judging on the heart level, not just the physical level? He's not being outrageous in his exhortation to take matters very seriously. He's actually being very loving. You can learn a lot about a person by what they say. You learn a lot about a person by what they say. First glance, he's audacious, radical, and outrageous. But more closely, he was just his kindness and his graciousness and his love toward us, because he never wanted you or me or any of the others who've heard those words to experience those exceedingly great. So the emphasis then is back to the heart. And if it is a matter of the heart, and if cutting hands off won't work and gouging eyes won't solve the matter of the heart, then he directs us to that word, if you look with desire. Directs us to that word, desire. And that word, desire, is an interesting word. It's used in a number of ways, like we do in English. It can have a positive focus or a negative focus. Jesus said himself, I have earnestly desired, same word, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover meal with you, my disciples. Or the rich man in Lazarus' story, Lazarus, it says, was longing, same word, longing just to be fed with the crumbs that were falling from the rich man's table. Paul elsewhere said, I have coveted no man's silver. He is the same word. Desire then is that intense longing or that desire for, and how we apply that desire is whether is how it takes on the moral quality. Amazingly, the Pharisees were fixated only on the outward command. But we, just as amazingly, 2,000 years after Jesus gave the correction that we've been looking at this morning, 2,000 years later, we gather in circles like this, and in congregations, and small groups, and Bible studies, and we discuss what Jesus meant, and yes, he was using hyperbole. He never expected us to do this, to whack off our arms, and pretty much after we discuss it, we go on our way, and we miss the fact that Jesus was saying take radical action to avoid succumbing to temptation. How is it that we also miss it? Do we take radical measures, drastic measures, desperate measures to avoid a seriously a grave outcome with a holy God? Do we? What do I mean by that? Well, Paul the Apostle said, put to death the deeds of the flesh. He said, I die daily. He said, flee youthful lusts. That sounds radical, doesn't it? That sounds drastic. Jesus said, hack it off, gouge it out. But when it comes to us, do we give up cable? Well, I got this thing. It's okay. Really? Do we stop going to that gym where we are bombarded with things that just overwhelm us? No. You know, it says be in the world, not of it. We placate ourselves with things like that sometimes. Have you ever in a theater just gotten up at in the middle of the theater and walked out of the movie because of the wrongness of what you were being forced to watch? Magazine comes to you in the mail. Do you ask your wife to look through it first and sanctify some of the images or tear them out before you see it? Do we refuse to shop at a convenience store where the temptation we know is too great for us to come out victoriously? Do we do these things because of a holy God and because the heart is the key and because of the grave consequences that Jesus is warning us about? Or do we instead come up with creative rationalizations that say things like, hey, there's no harm in looking. Certainly not the first time. I'm just checking out the scenery, admiring God's creation. Or, hey, it's only natural. This was born this way. And women might say, hey, it's not my problem. I can't help what they're thinking about or what they're looking at. You know, something seems missing with those kinds of responses. Because the issue isn't outward conformity, it's the issue of the heart, a pure heart before God. And it doesn't seem like with those kinds of answers, we're wrestling with the deepest heartfelt issues before a holy God who is going to establish grave consequences for sin. A man named Bob noticed he had decreasing vision in one eye. He thought it would get better, but it didn't. Finally, he went to see a doctor. He learned there that he had a cancerous tumor in his eye. The doctor was very frank with him. He said, if the cancer from the tumor gets to the optic nerve, it will quickly spread to your brain, and your condition will be terminal. Drastic measures would need to be taken. He would have to have the eye removed right away if he would want any prospect of beating the cancer. Bob made that agonizing decision to have his eye removed so his life could be spared. Was that a drastic measure? Absolutely. Were the consequences even more grave? No question. Do we take matters of our spiritual health that seriously? I dare say anyone in this room, if he were presented with losing an eye or dying in short order, he would say, I don't want to lose that eye. It's one of the dearest things to me. But if you'll take it so that I can be spared, my life can be spared, I'll pay that price. But what price are we willing to pay to protect our purity before God? The title for today's message is Purity at All Costs. And that's what Jesus seems to be saying. Don't just work by the letter of the law, work by the spirit of the law. Purity at all costs. Yes, I gave you hyperbole. Don't you see what I'm really trying to get at? Purity at all costs. Are you familiar with the man named Aaron Ralston? He was an avid mountain climber, very experienced. One time he was solo mountain climbing in a canyon slot in southern Utah. You know what a canyon slot is? It's something about 3 or 4, 6 or 8 feet wide, and they go straight down, and I don't know why people climb those, but they do, and this guy was down in there. Guess what? If you have a cell phone, there's no way you can get your cell phone signal out. And he was climbing alone, Aaron Ralston was. While climbing, he accidentally dislodged a large boulder, they estimate to be about 1,000 pounds. It came loose and pinned his hand and arm to the canyon. It made several mistakes. One was climbing alone. Another was not having told anyone where he was or where he was going. He had no way to call for help. 5 days went by. He began to realize that his hand, with the blood being cut off, was already putrefying already. He began to realize that he was going to die if he didn't take drastic measures. On the 6th day, he made a tourniquet, and he proceeded to cut off his own arm and break the bone with that very boulder. Cut the arm off. After that, he rappelled down the mountain and hiked for 5 hours till he was rescued. Was that drastic? Was it life-saving? Without question. He tells a story in his book, Between a Rock and a Hard Place. It's now a New York Times bestseller. He did the unthinkable to save his life. So many of us say, I'm not sure I could do that. But he was desperate, desperate to live. Sometimes you and I must do the unthinkable in our fight against sin. That will call for desperate measures, drastic